What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
So our guest today is Bill Ayers, Distinguished Professor of Education and Senior University Scholar, the University of Illinois at Chicago, retired. A graduate of the University of Michigan, the Bank Street College of Education, Bennington College and Teachers College, Columbia University, is an engaged scholar and a peace and social justice activist who has written extensively about social justice and freedom, democracy and education, the cultural context of schooling and teaching as an essentially intellectual, ethical and political enterprise. He is a former vice president of the curriculum division of the American Educational Research Association and a former member of the executive committee of the Faculty Senate at UIC. And a radical organizer that has inspired so many of us. Mr. Ayers, it's an honor to have you on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kat. It's a pleasure to be here, truly.
And you have a new book out, When Freedom is the Question, Abolition is the Answer, Reflections on Collective Liberation. Because it's you, I want to start with some about you. You are a movement legend, and I know many of my listeners are fan-peopling, as I am fangirling in this moment. Talk to us about where, how you grew up, and what were your early political influences?
Well, you know, I grew up in the 1940s and 50s, so I came of age in the 1960s. But one of the things, you know, I came out of a very privileged background. I came out of a prep school. And I found myself at the University of Michigan in 1963. And it was like being slapped awake, you know. Suddenly from my small privileged cocoon, I saw a world on fire. And I immediately joined up. I mean, I joined up with the resistance. So I got deeply involved in the Black Freedom Movement. And the Civil Rights Movement was that contemporary iteration of a centuries-old Black Freedom Movement. And now we're living through another iteration, another upsurge, which is super encouraging and hopeful and terrifying all at once, you know. But I got involved in that. And in 1965, I was arrested at a protest, one of the early international days of protests against the war in Vietnam. And I had dropped out of college. I dropped out of Michigan, joined the Merchant Marines when I was in Greece, in Ceuta. I was reading the International Herald Tribune, first time I'd heard of Vietnam. I came home, I went back to Ann Arbor, and I got involved in the anti-war movement, and I was arrested with 39 other people tearing up files inside a draft board. It was not a popular thing to do at that time, but it was, for me, a moral imperative. I had heard a leader of Students for a Democratic Society say to me at this teach-in, the first teach-in that we ever had, and this leader of SDS said, "You young people have to figure out how to live your life in a way that it doesn't make a mockery of your values." And that phrase hit me hard right between the eyes, and it has stayed with me. How do you live a life that doesn't make a mockery of what you believe in and what you hope for?
That just hit me between the eyes. Talk to me about, two-part question. Talk to me about the formation of the Weather Underground, but also, you know, over the last 10 years or so, there've been some really active conversations about white allies, white accomplices. Talk about what it means to be an accomplice in the struggle for Black liberation, Black freedom.
Well, you know, the Weather Underground was a result of, I mentioned I was arrested in 1965. For when I was arrested, even in a hotbed like Michigan, like the University of Michigan, we had a rally on the campus of about 300 people. We marched over to the draft board, we picketed, and 39 of us went in and began to disrupt and destroy files. It was a militant demonstration, but it's worth remembering that we were surrounded by 2,000 students who wanted to see us arrested and expelled from school. So the idea that it was popular is a myth. That's myth number one. It wasn't popular. you know, it's sometimes easy to say, oh, the 60s, everything was possible. First of all, there is no such thing as the 60s. Nobody looked at their watch on December 31st, 1969 and said, oh my God, it's almost over. Let's get high. I mean, we did get high, but not because anything was ending. Nobody lives by decades. That is marketing. That is myth making. And nothing depresses me more now as an old person than old people like myself who are nostalgic for a ship that already left the shore. That ship is gone. You're living now. You should be looking forward. But okay, 1965, I'm arrested. Over the next 3 years, I mean, and maybe 20% of Americans are against the war. Over the next 3 years, I'm arrested several times. I'm door knocking. I'm campaigning. I'm writing letters. I'm serving time. All the things one does when they're trying to be part of building a movement. That was super important over those 3 years. Much more important was the Black Freedom Movement came out, not unanimously, but significantly against the war. Martin Luther King's speech on April 4th, 1967, the speech called Beyond Vietnam, which your listeners can find online, is one of the most militant statements against war that I've ever read. That's the statement where he says, I regret to say it, but my country is the greatest purveyor of violence on earth.
They asked if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problem, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed and the ghetto. Without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government, for the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent.
He says we were on the wrong side of the world revolution. He says we need to oppose the three evils, militarism, racism, and materialism. I mean, it's such a profound and powerful talk. And he gave that talk over about a 2 or 3 year period. So that was important. Muhammad Ali, the great hero of being number one, a courageous, independent thinking black man, but he said, I won't join the white man's army. I won't, no Viet Cong ever called me the N-word. I won't go and fight for them.
Why should me and other so-called Negroes go 10,000 miles away from home here in America to drop bombs and bullets on other innocent brown people who's never bothered us? And I will say directly, no, I will not go 10,000 miles to help or kill innocent people.
And the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, again, setting the moral agenda by leading the freedom rides and leading the lunch counter sit-ins. In 1966, they said no black man should go 10,000 miles away to fight for a so-called freedom that he doesn't enjoy in Mississippi. So the Black Freedom Movement began to turn the country in a very powerful way. And perhaps even more significant than that was young men came home from Vietnam and told the truth about what they were asked to do there, about what they saw there, about what they suffered there. And that began to really change the anti-war movement and the nation as a whole. So by 1968, over 50% of Americans are against the war. And worldwide, the entire world is against the American intervention in Vietnam. So early 1968, March 1968, Lyndon Johnson, the president of the United States, goes on television and says, I will not run for re-election. I will work now to end the war in Vietnam. Well, we were ecstatic. Those of us who'd spent 3 years as full-time anti-war activists, we felt we'd won. Yes, a million people were dead. Yes, many, many Americans had their lives destroyed as well. But the war was going to end. And 5 days after Johnson gave that speech, Martin Luther King was murdered. And 2 months after that, Kennedy was murdered. And a few months after that, it was very clear the war would not end. The war would escalate and expand under Nixon and Kissinger into Cambodia, into Laos. And the war was not going to end. It was going to go on. And what we were facing, Kat, was we were facing the reality that 6,000 people a week were being murdered by our government, and there was no end in sight. It's hard to wrap your mind around it. 6,000 people a week, and we had tried everything, and we thought we'd succeeded, but now the war would expand and extend. So this was a crisis for the anti-war movement. It was a crisis for democracy. And you asked about the beginnings of the Weather Underground. There were five people in my birth family. I was the middle of five. One of my brothers joined the Democratic Party and tried to build a peace wing. One of my brothers went to the communes and tried to escape the madness. One went to Canada and built a home for deserting GIs to get them to Africa or to Europe or wherever they wanted to go. And one went and worked in a factory and tried to organize factory workers. And I did what I did. That is, I was one of the people who founded and led the Weather Underground for the next 11 years. And what was our point? What were we trying to do? We were trying to issue a screaming response to genocide, a screaming response to police murder of Black citizens, a screaming response to law and disorder. I mean, we were trying to say, you know, we are standing up against this. And, you know, while I don't defend everything we did, I don't think any one of my siblings or me was crazy. I also think it's important to note that we did not end the war. We limited the options, perhaps, of the war makers. We made an impact, perhaps, on American society. But to our great shame, the war dragged on for seven more years at the rate of 6,000 people a week being murdered by our government.
The second part of that question is,
yeah.
So out here in the Bay, right, we talk a lot about following Black leadership, and not just competent Black leadership. And there's lots of conversation about what it means to be a white accomplice. I don't have any interest in allies. And you all, in a lot of ways, set the standard for that. So I'd just like to hear your thoughts on being white accomplices inside of the movement.
Yeah.
I heard you talk about how the Black Freedom Movement shifted the world and created the moral container. But what did that mean for you in action and praxis?
Well, one of the things that defined the so-called New Left was that we believed a couple of things. One is we believed in participatory democracy. We thought formal democracy was a sham. The other thing we believed is that the people with the problems are the people with the solutions. And get over your Harvard degree or your appointment to the State Department or your university sinecure. Get over it. People know what's going on. And if you turn to the people themselves, you can learn a lot. That's been a defining feature of my teaching from 1965 to today. But yes, we felt very strongly that because America was built on white supremacy, because white supremacy wasn't a sidebar or a side problem, it was the heart of the matter. It was not only the original sin of this country, but it was baked into every part of our DNA. And what that meant was the people who were going to lead the way were the people who themselves who were suffering. I often think back to, well, Fred Moten said it best. He said, freedom dreams were born in the hold of a slave ship. And in Illinois, where I do much of my prison work and much of my advocacy, we abolished the death penalty 20 years ago. Where did that come from? That came from the men on death row themselves organizing what became known as the Death Row 10. It wasn't some brilliant idea from some graduate student at Northwestern. It wasn't the good heart of the governor. It was the fact that the guys on death row themselves first organized a law school class where they taught each other the law and then began to identify that they were suffering the same kind of oppression. And then they named that oppression and then they started a movement. So it's worth remembering that you can talk about the abolitionist movement, and we should, but it was the self-liberating enslaved workers who drove the crisis. And that's what we see again and again. So we believed in Black leadership. We not only believed in it, but I'm uncomfortable with the word ally. Okay, if you want to say ally, the first step of being an ally, if you want to use that word, is listening and paying attention. It's not knowing shit and telling people what to think. It's paying attention to what people are telling you is going on. It's paying attention to the death row 10, to the escaping enslaved workers, and so on. So if you want to know how to move, you have to pay attention and open your eyes to the people who are suffering the lash and showing us a way out. So I don't use the word ally. I like the word accomplice. The word I use is comrade, because comrades are not doing a service to somebody else. Comrades are shoulder to shoulder in the mess and in the mix with people themselves. So let's use an analogy. If, you know, I often go back to James Baldwin, who was so brilliantly said, when black people free themselves, white people will be freed. Really? Freed from what? Freed from the precarious position of being the master. And that position we know is precarious. Imagine the Virginia planters when the Haitian Revolution happened. Their minds were blown. They knew that they were a minority. They knew that their whole enterprise depended on, you know, holding on with all their might to the most precarious of positions. And they knew the day was coming when revenge, retribution, reparations was going to be on the table. So if you want to join with the movement for abolition of slavery, you are a comrade, because you know that your life depends on Africans being freed. It doesn't, it's not you're being nice to people. It's that your own life gets better when male supremacy falls, when hetero supremacy falls, when white supremacy falls. All of our lives will get better. And if you believe that deep enough in your soul, then you don't quibble about, you know, am I helping you? And with it, you're saying, I'm a comrade. I'm in this struggle to the end. So for me, the reason I have John Brown tattooed on my back, and the reason I'm a member of John Brown Lives, because he's the one white person in American history I can look to. He wasn't perfect. He was flawed like all of us, but he threw in with the abolitionist movement in a way that few other white people did.
You are listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Bill Ayers. He has a new book out, When Freedom is the Question, Abolition is the Answer, Reflections on Collective Liberation. One more praxis or analysis question before we move on to some specifics in the book. But you talked about, you know, the ways in which, these are my words, not yours exactly, the ways in which the 60s are, you know, romanticized. That ship has sailed. We are living now. Good organizers, we evolve, we change, we shift as the political conditions and the needs of the masses, right? That's what dictates our work, not this romanticization of what happened before. How has the way that you've looked at struggle shifted over the last four decades or so?
Well, I'm not sure I can generalize, but it shifts every day. You know, one of the things that I think is important, I agree with you, you know, that we can mythologize and look backward in ways that are not helpful to us today. I get very impatient when people say, oh, I wish I'd been born in the 60s. No, we are born now. It's true that people make history, but we don't make history in the conditions that we ourselves create. We make history on the conditions that are given to us. So one of our responsibilities is to name the political moment and to open our eyes and be aware. And that's not something you could do once and then put on automatic pilot, because the political moment is ever shifting. It's ever changing, and you are shifting. So I hope we're not the same as we were when we were 15 or 25 or 35. And I hope we won't be the same, you know, when I'm 85 or 95, you know, I mean, you have to keep growing and keep going. But I think that for me, the rhythm of activism has remained the same, but the specifics of it have changed dramatically. And I mean activism and organizing. I think they're different, but I think they're both hugely important. And for me, the rhythm is the same. You have to open your eyes and pay attention. If you don't open your eyes and see the world as it is and pay attention to it and study it and wake up to it, you can't make clear decisions. So you have to open your eyes. I think the second step is you have to be astonished. Astonished at both the beauty and the ecstasy that human beings can create, and also the unnecessary suffering and pain that human beings inflict on one another. I think that we have to be astonished and not get used to it. In other words, when I see homeless kids in Chicago, if I ever get used to that, you know, throw me off the bridge. I mean, I should not get used to that. I should be astonished every time. And then I have to act, and I have to act up in some ways. My students often say to me, well, I don't know what's the best thing to do. I don't know the best thing to do either. That's why I think of Miriam Kaba saying you should engage in a million experiments, that you don't have to know the perfect thing to do. Do something, and do something with others, and then connect it to other something. So step three is do something, act. And step four is rethink. Question yourself. Don't be so sure that what you did was perfect. Go back to the beginning and start over. Open your eyes, pay attention, be astonished, act, doubt, repeat. And that to me is a constant. That's what we have to all be doing all the time. But the times change, the world changes. Anyone who is an internationalist today has to be throwing their shoulder against the pre-announced genocide in Gaza. That's what we have to do. Now, you know, I can go back and look at the early documents of the Weather Underground or even some documents from SDS and see that we stood for the Palestinians. But now we're in a crisis, and we're in a crisis that demands our full energy and our strength and our weight. So that's different than it was before, even though, you know, in principle, I believe that the Palestinian people have a right to self-determination. But the actions that you take today are different.
Thank you for that. That segues into the first question I had regarding chapter one, when freedom is the question. Given the turbulence of these political times, as you lay out in the book, some of the most horrific things imaginable are happening, the genocide moving in Palestine, the state law enforcement has murdered more of us post-2020 than they were annually before that. But we're also, as you point out, seeing massive resistance to the status quo with millions of us in the street. I mean, APTP, my organization, Anti Police Terror Project, we've stood with, you know, our Palestinian relatives here for the 15 years that we've been in existence, never saw what we're seeing right now. It's remarkable and a testament to organizing, yes. How do you talk about freedom in the context of that dichotomy, the horror and the resistance, the beauty of the resistance that we're seeing?
I want to just emphasize first the point you're making about the beauty of the resistance. You know, if you'd said to me 2 years ago, large numbers of the American people will wake up to the reality of Israel and its role in the Middle East and the reality of the U.S. complicity, not only complicity, but material support for that genocide. If you'd told me that 2 years ago, I would have said, no way. But what happened in the last, really happened within the first couple months, the last months of 2023, is that the Palestinian diaspora, Students for Justice in Palestine, Jewish Voice for Peace, the dissenters, these folks stood up and acted out with courage, with determination, and with consistency. They organized and they acted. And in that organizing and that acting, built, as you implied, built on decades of organizing, decades of activism, but built on that, within 2 months, the narrative about Israel as an embattled democracy surrounded by anti-Semites, that myth was shattered. And I think that we should take credit for that. Now, it hasn't translated into policy, and we should feel anger and grief about that. But somehow you have to hold two ideas in your mind at the same time. You know, so Bernadine and I were on 55th Street in Chicago at one of our favorite restaurants. It's the Nile. And we've gone there for decades. When Rashid and Mona Khalidi lived in Chicago, we always were there with them. And the old man who owned the restaurant has given it to his son, but he happened to be in the restaurant last week when we were there. And he came over to our table, and we hugged, and he sat down. And he said, in a course of about 15 minutes, he said, of course, I'm filled with grief, and I'm filled with anger for what's happening in my homeland, for the relatives lost, for the communities destroyed. He said, but if you had told me 10 years ago that the American people would ever wake up to the reality of what Israel is, I'd have said, you're nuts. But it's happened. So my grief and my anger is also tempered with joy and with hope. And I think that that's a very important dialectic that we have to live with. Yes, things are terrible. Things are miserable. But yes, there should be hope, because we can do amazing things. We've seen it before. History can be made by people, and we should be part of that making of history.
You alluded to this earlier, actually, and it was in my question. Freedom, you know, it's a word is really casually thrown around. To my mind, as a Black person in this country, a Black woman in this country, it, you know, it leaves a bitter taste in my mouth. I'm like, when I hear, for instance, you know, America's a land of the free, my knee-jerk brain response is free for who? Because quiet as it's kept, white folks ain't free here either.
That's right.
So if you could just tug on that thread a little bit more than you did earlier.
Well, I think that, you know, I think that you're absolutely right. Freedom is one of the most layered and complex terms ever. And I often say to my students, you know, the civil rights, I mean, the Civil War was fought for freedom, right? And everybody says, yes, right. What was the freedom it was fighting for? Well, it was fighting to free the enslaved African workers. And then I point out, if you go back and read the documents, the Confederacy was also fighting for freedom. Freedom against a tyrannical national government, freedom to own other people, which was traditional, which was our right, which we are, should be free to do. So everyone was fighting for freedom. And it's worth remembering that now, when we have the Freedom Caucus, a right-wing group of, you know, insane people. We have the insufferable Ron DeSantis writing a book called The Courage to Be Free. But we also have women's liberation and queer liberation and the Black freedom movement on the rise once again. So let's fight over that contested term, and let's embrace a North Star that includes not just my freedom to drill an oil well, which I'm, you know, it's that toxic individualism, but the subtitle of the book is Reflections on Collective Liberation. And that's what I want us to think about. I want us to think about how can we be free as individuals, but within a community, within a collective. And I think this is something that Black people have pioneered. I think that, you know, if you look back, I mentioned the Civil War. If you look at the period of Reconstruction, that's the one period in American history where we had a multinational democracy. And it was led by Black, formerly enslaved people, who pointed the way to a possible world that was violently defeated, violently subdued, and it took another 100 years for the freedom movement to find its legs and create the modern civil rights movement. That also ended in some compromise, some defeat, and here we are again with Black Lives Matter rising up. And I think we should thank our stars that we're alive at a time like this, when we can lend our shoulder to that wheel and make a difference, because we can and we must. Now, you know, I have to say, because I'm often accused of being an optimist and being a romantic and an idealist and a utopian. I'm often accused of that. And I argue back and I say it's not true. I'm neither an optimist nor a pessimist, because optimists and pessimists know what's going to happen. And because I have no idea what's going to happen, I choose to be hopeful. I choose to wake up every morning and say, today, we will link arms today. We will articulate our vision more clearly. We will organize more people into the movement, and we will push that rock up a hill. Absolutely. And I go to bed every night disappointed that I didn't overthrow capitalism. But I get up the next morning and I say, maybe today. And I believe that that's an important way to live the life of an activist without completely burning out and just being engulfed by despair.
You naturally segued into a question I was going to ask you later. It's something I struggle with, for real. And you talked about, like, watching millions of people in the streets and believing deeply, right? I believe deeply that it is us. It is the power of the people. It is the masses that will finally make this, you know, make force power to concede. And to watch the absolute disregard, the absolute ignoring of tens of millions of people, it's been a crisis as an organizer and an activist. It's been a crisis, because it's like, well, this is what you tell and what your mentors, teachers have told you, this is what you're supposed to do. And what does then escalation look like is, I think, a question. I'm not necessarily asking you that. I'm just saying that's the question I think that's on a lot of our minds, is like, all right, well, the genocide has to stop. The police have got to stop killing us, right? The unhoused have got to be housed. Like, I live in the birthplace of the Black Panther Party. We got 10,000 Black people sleeping on street corners.
Yeah, I know. And it's an outrage. It's an outrage. And we should be outraged. But when you point out that they ignore us and that they come back stronger and that the backlash can feel more overwhelming than where we started, that's all true. I think I often think of a demonstration we organized against the war in Vietnam in 1967. We brought 500,000 people to Washington to storm the Pentagon. And the headline in the New York Times the next day was, "Richard Nixon reports he didn't know you were there." Why did he say that? He said 500,000 people were storming his government. Well, it was important for him to make us feel that he didn't know we were there. He clearly knew we were there. And even saying, "I didn't know you were there," is a way of acknowledging we were there. But I think sometimes we rely too much on arguing about things like what were the numbers at the demonstration or, you know, those kind of things. I think that the reason that we have to continue to nourish hope in ourselves and in each other is because that's the territory on which we're strong. We're stronger than they are. And their power is precarious and our power is real. I think sometimes, and in this election year, I think it's worth saying, sometimes we on the left spend too much time staring at the sites of power we have no access to. The Pentagon, Wall Street, the White House, the medieval auction block called the Congress, and too little time looking at the sites of power we have absolute access to. The community, the workplace, the school, the house of worship. That's where our power is. That's the power we have to mobilize. That's the power we have to be comfortable in. And often I think we should always have a North Star. That North Star should always be changing. It's not a roadmap as much as it's a hopeful vision of a world that could be or should be, but is not yet. And I think that we need to nourish that sense. I'll tell you a funny story. We met the great Uruguayan writer and revolutionary Eduardo Galeano at a party in Chicago 10 or 15 years ago. And we were joking about the fact that we're both often accused of being utopian. And Galeano said, "You know, somebody said to me recently, what good is utopia?" And Galeano said, "It's true. I take two steps towards utopia. Utopia walks two steps away. I walk 10 steps towards utopia. Utopia walks 10 steps away. So what good is utopia?" And his response, "It's good for walking." And I think that's true. I think we have to know that even though it's blurry and even though it's on the far horizon, another world is not only possible, it's essential. If we don't build another world, it's the end of the human experiment. I mean, we must find a way to address the crisis of the cataclysmic capitalist climate collapse. We have to address the crisis of raging cops killing black people. We have to address the crisis of a carceral state. We have to address the crisis of women being asked to get back into the medieval cave that some people want them to live in. And I think we are. I mean, I look at the uprising of women across the political spectrum to say, you know what? I wasn't paying close enough attention when Dobbs was the new decision and Roe was overturned. I'm paying attention now, and thank God you are, because we need to move forward on every front to refuse to be put back into the Middle Ages on every level.
You are listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. I'm in conversation with Bill Ayers. He has a new book out, When Freedom is the Question, Abolition is the Answer, Reflections on Collective Liberation. Bill, what do you mean by, specter of freedom can appear in contexts that are decidedly violent or nonviolent? That's part one. And then two, who gets to define what violence is?
Well, exactly. One of the things about the ruling class in this country and about the power in this country is they want a monopoly on violence, and they want to tell everybody who opposes them that they somehow are the violent people. And I was just in high school today. We had a long, complicated conversation about violence and nonviolence, because it's easy enough for us to see an overt act as an example of violence. and miss the fact that certain relationships are violent by their nature. They're violent by their nature because they rely on violence, whether it's expressed explicitly or implicitly. Just two quick examples. No colonized people ever invited the French or the British or the Belgians in. They came in, and they came in violently. And if you opposed it, you saw what the violence was. Slavery. You could have two generations living on a plantation, never lifting a whip or a finger against each other. The system was maintained by violence. And then when Denmark Vesey or Nat Turner start to stand up, the people in power all say, oh, that's so violent. What a terrorist. Look, killing children. I mean, what is he doing? Right? But they miss the fact that the relationship was violent, and standing up to end the relationship, while it may take the form of explicit actions that seem violent or that are violent, that's not where the violence originated. The violence came from the system of slavery. Ending the system was essential. And without defending what Nat Turner did, 14 years after he did it, slavery was gone. So, you can't kind of freeze frame and say, this is an act of violence and this is something else. Again, you say, who defines what violence is? It's the powerful. It's the capitalist class or their political apologists. So the United States likes to think of itself, and we as Americans like to think of ourselves as peaceful people. But we also have a $1 trillion military budget. We have, we have military bases scattered across the globe, and we have at least two wars going on at all times. We're exporting violence constantly. That's why Martin Luther King said, we are the most violent purveyors, the most widespread purveyors of violence in the world. That's truer today than it was when he said it.
And then, of course, at home, right, the violence of the carceral state.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying, absolutely, at home, what is the prison system if not congealed violence? Congealed violence executed against certain people. So, I was talking to these high school kids today, and we were talking about one of my students who shot a rival drug dealer in a spat over opioids. He didn't kill him. So he's doing just 10 years for armed violence. And it was a violent act. And then you think of the Sacklers, who created the opioid crisis and destroyed thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives and entire communities. And they're not called violent. In fact, they get off with a slap on the wrist and a little chump change because their offenses were nonviolent. I think those distinctions are nonsense. And I think when I work with my students to end mass incarceration in Illinois and in the country, we think the distinction between violent and nonviolent crime is nonsensical in their lives. I mean, yes, some of what they did was violent, and some of what was done to them was violent as well. So my friend Rinaldo Hudson, one of my friends and mentors, Rinaldo says, look, I like the second chance movement. I think that's good. But I never had a first chance. I never met anyone on death row who had a first chance. I never had a fair chance. I was homeless and I was illiterate and I was living in a sewer of violence when I was arrested and when I committed my crime. Where's my chance, right? And he says, I also like the Innocence Project. Obviously, people who didn't commit crimes should get out. But I committed the crime they convicted me of. And I'm also still human. Can I be redeemed? Can I find a way into the human community? I have to. I must. And this society should help us.
So many threads to tug on there, and I'm clocking my time. I just said to a comrade not too long ago, they talk out of both sides of the neck. We've got to invest inside of the prison system because people are going to get rehabilitated. Oh, no, wait. They actually can't be rehabilitated. They have to stay there forever. The contradictions. And to the point about, right, folks not having a first chance, that's why the thread through the defund conversation for us has always been about real public safety strategies, and real public safety strategies not responding after the fact. It's addressing all of the root causes before the fact.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why so many great abolitionists, from Ruthie Gilmore to Angela Davis to Erica Miners to Bernardine Dorn, they always say the true nature of abolition is world building. It's not erasure or unlocking doors, although that's part of it. And if you ask me, I'd like to bulldoze Stateville Prison by myself. So, okay, I get that. But the real thing is, just imagine, Kat, imagine you and me and a small group in Oakland, and we're sitting down, and it's 1845 or 1850, and we're abolitionists, and we've got a vision. We're going to do away with slavery as a system. But slavery is so entangled in our country. It's not just plantations in the South. It's the wealth of the nation. It's banks. It's shipping companies. It's Brown University. It's Harvard. It's all implicated in slavery. But we're going to end it, we think. And it's 1850, and we're at our little meeting in the community. And some of us are going to write leaflets. Some of us are going to write a newspaper. Some of us are going to knock doors. Some of us are going to campaign for this or that candidate. And some of us are going to build an underground. But it's 1850. And little did we know, because we were a tiny minority, tiny. And because we were abolitionists, we were against the Constitution, the law, the founders, our parents, the Bible. But so what? We're going to end slavery. And who would have thought that 15 years later it would be done? Slavery would be gone. And then we had to build a world where the idea of slavery was impossible, that slavery was no longer in our imagination, but rather abolition was in our imagination. Now, we didn't win everything. Obviously, the notion of selective humanization endured. And that led to the death of Reconstruction. It led to the lynching regime. It led to Jim Crow. It led to mass incarceration. And it's still going on. So we have a hell of a lot of work to do. But I think we should take heart from the fact that our predecessors, the abolitionists of 1850, they also had a vision. And it was a vision of a world without slavery. We can imagine a world without a carceral state, without prisons, and without police. I can imagine it. And now I want to build that world. And I want to build it in a way that makes it irresistible.
Last question, because of the tyranny of the clock, not because it's the last question I have for you, but I'm going to figure out a way to talk to you again.
We can continue anytime.
I talk about abolition, of course, on the show a lot. And I always ask folks, how do they define abolition? And it's always different. And it always helps my definition expand. So that's what I'd like to end on. What does it mean to you?
Well, I think that abolition, like democracy, like freedom, it's a moving target. And it should be. That is, we abolish slavery. And if I say to this group of high school kids, what's abolition? They say, getting rid of slavery. And that's true. But we have much more world building to do. So I don't want them to get stuck there, right? And I think of abolition as the identification of a wall, the identification of a barricade that's standing in the way of you and your neighbor's humanity, full humanity. And knocking against that wall is the work of abolition. One of the things that I take heart from, I'm going to give you a last quick example. You know, the guys on death row I mentioned, they built a group called the Death Row 10. That led to the mothers of the Death Row 10. And the mothers of the Death Row 10 led to getting journalists and lawyers involved in a way they hadn't been involved. And suddenly there was a movement. There was door knocking. There was propaganda. One of the most effective was a radio show that the activists started called Live from Death Row. And the death row inmate would call somebody and we'd broadcast it in a church and there'd be 300 people listening to a death row inmate, so-called worst of the worst, the most heinous people on earth. Suddenly we see them as three-dimensional, with a face, with a mother and a father, with people who love them, with artistic projects that they're working on, with hope, with generosity, with grace. And then we begin to think, oh, there's something wrong here. And who could have believed when we started that within a few years, Illinois would lead the nation in doing away with the death penalty. Our corrupt right-wing governor would clear death row 20 years ago this year, clear death row. So we got rid of death by execution. But several of our friends and comrades who we worked closely with who were on death row are working double hard to do away with death by incarceration, by which we mean life without the possibility of parole. And in Illinois, we have no parole system. So we're hammering away at death by incarceration. And at the same time, we're saying, what would it look like to live in a world without prisons? Can we imagine that? And we don't have to have a roadmap to it, but can we posit that North Star? And can we begin to work toward that North Star? And the answer is yes. And the reason it's yes is because we got rid of the death penalty, death by execution. No one thought it was possible, but we did it. And because we did that, we can do the next thing. Let's keep marching. Let's stay strong. Let's link together arm in arm, heart to heart, over the next barricade.
Bill Ayers, thank you so much for this conversation.
Kat, I really appreciate you, and let's chop it up again.
Absolutely. Y'all, you've been listening to Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks, and I've been in conversation with Bill Ayers. He has a new book out, When Freedom is the Question, Abolition is the Answer, Reflections on Collective Liberation. You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.